introduce Rachel, and can everyone please give her a warm welcome.
Thanks, Simon. My name's Rachel and I'm an addict.
Hi, Rachel.
And it just struck me as a bit funny when you read that I'm going to talk for 40 minutes, because I couldn't do a whole sentence when I came here. At the end of my using, I didn't speak in whole sentences. I spoke into my sleeve and people couldn't understand what I said. And they would ask me to repeat myself a couple of times before I just got frustrated and swore and left, because I just was so broken by my using by the time I got here. And I didn't at the time, but now I consider myself to be very lucky that it went so wrong so quickly for me. When people talk about, you know, they had good times in their using, some people are going to need to hear that to identify with it as well. It's nothing to feel guilty about, that if I had a good time on drugs, but I didn't have many good times on drugs. Like Simon shared before, I started on alcohol, I didn't like it. I was already angry, it made it worse. I liked solvents because then I could be in a completely different place altogether. And I liked running around tripping and lying on the floor, laughing at nothing for hours on end. And I thought that was all quite funny. And that it was kind of, that I was treading a fine line somewhere. So somewhere I did know that I was fucking with my sanity, and that I could go too far and I might not come back. And I did have my suspicions that I wasn't a stable enough person in the first place to ever be touching those kinds of chemicals. But the don't care element of my character kicked in, and I cracked right on with that. But it started going wrong pretty quickly. When I was 18, I got strychnine poisoning in a squat in Wood Green off some dodgy windowpanes. And I lay on the floor for 3 days, throwing up, panicking, because I was supposed to be back somewhere else, going to court in a different county, and feeling really quite betrayed by these drugs that I'd gone out to have a good time and it hadn't. It had really kicked me in the teeth, and I became quite mistrustful then of chemicals. And there were certain things that I knew once I started doing, I was watching other people doing them around me, I did know that if I picked up needles, it was going to be all over pretty quick for me. And so I stalled it for as long as I could, but there was something about, it felt inevitable that I was going to, I could see people and they were jacking up in their feet and they couldn't put their boots on and they was throwing up in the street and they were, it didn't look good. And I knew that that was going to happen to me without me, before I'd even touched those drugs, I could see that I was going to follow them. And I did, and almost straight away I started seeing the casualties. I started seeing through what I was doing and I saw the consequences, and while I was still very young, people started dying around me. And the first time it happened, it was, most people around me were older than me, but a couple weren't. There was a couple of people my age, and there was one younger than me. And when I was 18 and just out and about and in town, I heard that he was dead. And I was shocked. I was really shocked. I was shocked that that could happen, but I wasn't shocked enough to stop doing what I was doing. I just somehow got that thing again. There was a certain amount of inevitability that that was going to happen to me. Not that I could do anything about it, not that I could change my direction, that I'd started on that and that was going to happen to me. And I think the thing that happened when people talk about it, they picked up their drug of choice and they felt like, you know, they were surrounded by love and warmth and the family and they'd come home. What happened to me was when I picked up opiates, I liked people, and that was an alien feeling to me. And I remember walking down the street, bumping into someone who I had a resentment with, like I did with most with the world, and thinking, I'm not bothered really.
thought, it's all right, just a bod.
And I thought, oh, fuck, this is what the rest of the world feels like. This is what all them simple people who go around smiling at each other and being nice and friendly, and this is how they feel. This is how they feel towards other human beings, that they're just all right. They're not, and that, ironically, is the first time I felt the same as everyone else. I thought that was probably what you were supposed to feel as a human being. I felt some kind of compassion, and I wouldn't go so far as to say empathy at that point, but I just felt some kind of warmness that thought, yeah, people are all right, really, and they can get on with what they're doing, and I'll get on with what I'm doing, and I'm not hurting anybody else. And I got sick pretty quick, and I thank God for that now. And the 4 years that followed that, there was nothing glamorous about my using. There was nothing exciting about my using. It went from traveller's sites to dodgy squats to flea pit council flats. It was just all that. I had no masquerade, no semblance of a double life. I was too unmanageable before I took drugs to even attempt to put up a front of a double life. There was no disguising the fact that I was a junkie and a head case, really, and I was a liability as a drug addict. I was probably the most miserable drug addict I've ever met. I was the most morose. I used to go begging, and people would ask me what I was begging for, and I'd tell them I was saving up for an overdose. And they'd give me money. They'd give me money to speed it up, you know, and I sort of affirmed that belief that, you know, that's that kind of, that ego, really, that the world would be a better place without me. And my actions did affect other people. I couldn't be relied on. I was a liability. And I spent a few years sort of alternating between the town centre, causing trouble, the city, the bedroom, other people's kitchens, and the nut house. That was my using. I would get out of hand, I'd get nutted off, and then I'd either escape or they'd let me out, or a couple of times I got thrown out. And that, I thought that they were my sort of greatest achievements at the time, were to be thrown out of a psychiatric ward. And I couldn't see any hope for change. And I was just talking to someone in the break just there about, we're talking about all night telly. And it weren't the same then. It was, in fact, it didn't even go on all night. There were teletext pages from about 4 o'clock. And just that sitting up, watching the telly, Grand Prix, Prisoner Cell Block H, teletext pages of Job Finder, waiting for the chemist to open, and nothing working, and just not sleeping, like ever. Because I didn't eat, ever. I never made the connection between those two, that you have to eat and go to sleep and get up in order to go to sleep again. There was just no pattern to it all. It was just a continuous scrabble around for money, for drugs, in that at the very best, were going to knock me out for a couple of hours. And they worked less and less as I wanted them to. I got less and less relief. The only time I got any time off from that hamster wheel was in between scoring and getting home. That was it. The waiting. As soon as they were done up. That was it, off again. And all the stuff that goes with it. Until I couldn't take the boredom. I couldn't take the emptiness. I couldn't take being so locked in to that life that I couldn't see anything, I couldn't hear anything. There wasn't any joy. I definitely didn't like people anymore. None of it was working. And I thought if I stayed away from the people, if I stayed away from certain things, I could lock it out. And I didn't know it was all inside, and it was all, my prison was inside my head. And I was so far locked in it that I couldn't speak, couldn't ask for help, I didn't know what to do. And I went to the only people I knew, which were the agency that gave me the needles and got me the prescriptions, who put me back in the nut house. that I'd been thrown out of and run away from and all that to do a detox. And that went wrong as well in its own way. And because that was naltrexone detox in 1994, what that meant was they give you a big hit in naltrexone. Ta-da. See you in 7 days' time. Here's some Complan. That was my detox, and it was fucking awful. And I was trying to write it down so that I'd remember it, because I knew I changed things in my head. That from truth to lies. Really, by the time they got from one side to the other, black's white and wrong's right, and I can recreate the whole thing. So I was trying to write it down, but I was so fucked on this detox, I couldn't write it down. It was just a load of scribble and drivel as my blood pressure was just dropping off the scale. And they took me to another hospital and gave me a big hit of Pethidine. And I thought, well, that's good. Pethidine, never tried that. I thought they'd give you that for childbirth, so it must be all right. And that didn't work. And that was a very long night. And that was the point, I think, that I first thought maybe what I need to do is not take any more drugs. And that had been suggested to me before. I've heard you say it by a doctor who said to me, like, if I said I've got a drug problem, he said, why don't you stop taking drugs then? But obviously this man's a fool, and he hasn't been trained properly. And it was too simple for me. There had to be a chemical solution, surely, to this chemical problem. So simple, it just went completely over my head. But when I rang the NA helpline, when they sent me back to the nut house without my naltrexone and offered to put me back on methadone, which I thought, I can't fucking go through that again. I can't go through it again. I'm 6 stone, I'm tired, I'm nuts, I can't watch any more telly, I can't do that again. And I rang up, there was a big poster outside the nurse's station that I must have shuffled past 1,000 times, saying, drug problem, maybe we can help. I thought, oh, maybe you can help. And I rang them up, and our helpline was a list of phone numbers. So I found that a bit overwhelming, hung up, rang back a few times, sort of picked a name I liked that didn't sound too trendy, and rang them up. And they told me about complete abstinence, and I thought, well, yeah, that's okay, because that's what, no smack and no downers, that's what I'm after. No alcohol, I thought, yeah, don't like it anyway, okay. No hash, oh, surely that's not a drug, really. That's sort of homeopathic, isn't it? That's, you know, okay. And I was quite intrigued, so I thought, don't take anything at all. They said, well, look, the best thing you can do really is come to a meeting. That's how you're going to find out what it's all about. And I was desperate to get out of the nut house for a night. And I went to this meeting in my sunglasses so they wouldn't know. And sort of sat through this meeting, trying not to scratch and listen to people. And it was bizarre. They were the friendliest people. Sort of offer you cigarettes and tea, talk to me, which I found it quite scary actually. I found that sort of direct, you know, it was quite direct, and it was very small, and I was like the newcomer. I got, you know, a lot of attention and but what they talked about, you know, they didn't give me any magic, they didn't tell me the answer. They didn't tell me what to do. They didn't tell me I'd have to do this if I wanted to join, that I'd have to, because I thought there must be some sort of requirement, you know, like you have to do a detox and finish it, and then, you know, you have to be off drugs to actually come in here and be with these people. And they said that thing about take the drugs outside the room, and then suddenly my pocket just felt like it had an anvil in it, like it was glowing in the dark, and I thought, fuck, I didn't even realise I had any drugs on me, and it was just a blim in a tin, and I sat there and I could feel this thing glowing, and it said, take your drugs outside the room and bring yourself back in. And that confused me a bit, because I was thinking, am I getting kicked out? Or, you know, and I thought, I'm in like Duke Street Leisure Centre. Someone might see me and take it. That was obviously my biggest fear. It's like, but also, I thought they're going to know then. If I get up and then come back in, they're going to know I've got drugs on me. And it's going to just blow my cover. So better I sit still and just keep quiet about that for now, because obviously I'm going to need that when I get out of here. And, you know, no alarms went off or anything. No one smelled it or, you know. So I sat there and plucked through this meeting. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And it was really simple stuff, you know. It was someone talking about, it was a step meeting, and every time you had a newcomer, because it's quite a sort of rare event, we'd go back to step one, and someone did a chair on step one. And he was really funny as well, and just talking about insanity. And just, I'd never heard of anyone talk about it like that. We were full of bravado stories when we were using it. We were going to clean up and get a bus and go to Portugal, you know, not get Hoover up first, you know what I mean? It's maybe get some petrol. But just mad sort of plans. And what these people were saying about their lives, and their lives without drugs, was that they had cars and licenses, they had things, they had TVs and videos, and they were happy, contented. They went out for coffee, and some of them had jobs. And I was like, oh, fantastic. And I really, really, really wanted some of that. Just people who got up and ate breakfast. And that was what I aspired to. It wasn't the big mad things. It was the people who came in and said, oh, you know, I've just had a row with my husband and I wanted to kill him, but I came here. Do you know what I mean? It was really like no big deal things, or people saying, God, I'm going to college and I'm really frightened, but I went and enrolled today. And I'd be like, wow, yeah, that's what I want to do. And people finding out who they were, it was a really exciting thing. Bear in mind, I was still using when I heard all this, when I first went to meetings. I was still using, and I did hear it, and I do firmly believe, I don't care what people have taken when they come in these rooms, I know what I heard when I came in, clucking off methadone, eating loads of benzos, stoned out of my head. I know what I heard when I came in, and it was enough to make me want to come back. And after a couple of weeks, it was enough to make me want to get clean. And after a couple of months, it was enough to make me get clean. And it sort of slowly, what I heard from people disarmed me of all my excuses to keep using drugs, because I'd go home, I'd hear all this stuff, and I'd go home and my head would be buzzing with these solutions that I was hearing. And the simpler they were, the more striking I found them. I think the most it's hard to say if one thing's more important than the other, but the thing that I really held on to, and I think the thing that saved me, that I heard straight away, was just for today. People saying, just for today, that's how I got clean. Just struggle through that first day. And people saying, just for today, and things I'd panic about. And I remember walking my dogs and walking down the street and all the things, and thinking, yeah, but I've done this and I've done that and I've done this to her and that to him, and I'm going to do this, but how am I going to do that? And it all just, it was all too much. It was like tripping again. It was, my early recovery was very trippy and fast and scary, and I'd just get so overwhelmed by the smallest things, till I'd be sat down by the river with my dogs crying because I didn't understand how I was going to do it. All I knew was that other people had done it, and I knew they were telling the truth, because things they'd said that only we know, things that they'd done that only we do, all added up. And that they'd done it. And the other thing I knew was that I only had to do it for a day. And every day after, I just lost it and thought, I can't possibly get through another day, I'd wake up the following day and I'd be so relieved that I hadn't used. I'd wake up and just go, oh, thank fuck for that. And every time I had a dream about using, and and I'd wake up panicking, thinking I must have done it, so I couldn't have not used anything. I must have somewhere slippered off and had a little hit, and woke up and realised that I hadn't. It was just a dream. The relief I felt, that I thought, God, well, if I do use, I'm going to wake up the next day and I'm not going to feel that. I'm going to feel the same. And someone told me, you know, in my very, very early days, I think I was like a week clean. My flat was full of drugs and drug addicts, and I had to step over them to get out of the house to go to meetings, and I didn't know how to get rid of them. I found out, actually, you just try and 12-step them and they all fuck off. worked for me. But I was, you know, and I was panicking and thinking, I've got that feeling it was inevitable again. Sooner or later, I was going to fuck it up, because I do that with everything. And this woman said to me, you know, she asked me what was going on, and I told her this and that was going on. And she said, well, it's nothing that bad that can't be made worse through picking up. I thought, fuck, that's true, actually. And then there was another one who said, he asked me what was wrong, and I said, just this and that and this. And he said, well, no, if you're clean today. And I said, yeah. He said, well, if you do the same things tomorrow, you'll be clean tomorrow, won't you? That's all you do. Keep doing it. That's all you do. And it was those things, those little gems, those things that I take for granted now, because I've heard them so many times, you know what I mean? The cliches that are the cliches because they work. That those are the things that were passed on to me, along with keep coming back. That was important. That was important for me. I'd never heard that before. I'd heard don't come back. I'd heard you'll be back. And things like that. I'd never heard keep coming back. That was a different kettle of fish altogether. And I found it difficult to join in. I did. I found a lot of people, where I got clean, it was a small town. Didn't do 1990 because there was two meetings a week. So everybody just went to both of them. That's how it worked. Or some people who had children, their partners went to kind of one each, or it was like that. And you could go to AA, who were very good to us as well, very welcoming and very tolerant, actually. And we could go there too. And so I just did as many meetings as I could. I found the coffee shop stuff hard. I found that hard. I didn't know how to chat. I didn't know how to have conversations that weren't about drugs or people that I knew that used drugs. I didn't know how to do that stuff, and I had to kind of follow people around a bit, really, and just sort of be mute. And they let me do that. And I was quite scared of people who had been clean a long time, and I didn't particularly trust their sort of relaxed behaviour. I wasn't altogether sure that they were fully telling the truth sometimes, because they were just too sort of relaxed. And so, you know, not all the time, but I knew that they were addicts, and I knew that they'd been where I'd been, but I didn't realise that they were still recovering, really, which is what I've learned now, you know, that we all just keep going and that we're all the same in here, just recovering a day at a time. I was a bit sort of in awe of the people that had been clean a long time, so I tended to stick to the people that hadn't, because I didn't feel like I was going to sort of, you know, say the wrong thing or... And I had one friend in particular who's still a very close friend of mine, and we kind of went through it all together, and we would go and speak to our sponsors and then come back and tell each other what they'd said. So it's like we had double the information, and we sort of like allied up on it, and we went through our steps together as well, and we would go off and come back and sort of confer on it. And then a lot of the time it felt like we were just trying not to score. That's all we were doing, was hanging out and trying not to score. But we did do that, and we kept each other safe, and we made each other laugh, and we used to laugh ourselves sick. I spent a lot of my very early recovery in sort of manic hysteria, with this woman, where we were just, it was, we felt like we were stoned because we were just so elated, and so we'd been so miserable for so long, and the sort of the freedom that we were going to live and that we had choices was quite overwhelming, and so we just ran around giggling for a year or so. We were very well tolerated in meetings as well, because we couldn't hold it together. An hour and a half was just too, we didn't have the concentration span, we couldn't do the readings. We just end up sort of sitting behind them, shaking, and certain words in the readings and stuff just crack us up. And that was, it was like that trippy thing all over again. It was like the bit I liked about using. It was the bit, that feeling alive and just the relief I used to feel in my first year, particularly around was the 6-month mark. It was winter. And for the first time in years, I could see, like, outside myself, I could see seasons changing, I could see things happening, I could see the world going on, and I was going to be part of it. And it was really, really exciting. You know, some of the terror that I would get sucked into an off-licence by some gravitational force of addiction, have a drink poured down my throat, had left me. And I felt like I could get through a day. Do you know what I mean? I didn't feel in mortal danger every time I stepped outside the door. I didn't feel like I was alone with a serial killer, that's how I felt in when I got clean. Someone said it to me once on the phone. They rang up and I was having a bad day. I'd never say this to anyone, but someone rang me up and they said, I'm having a bad day. I really want to use, because I just sort of, if I was having a bad day, I assumed I wanted to use. I never really thought about whether I did or not, really, but I really want to use. So I thought I had to say that if I was allowed to tell someone I was, you know, what the problem was. And they say, "God, are you alone in the house?" And I said, "Yeah." They said, "Oh, you're alone with a killer, get out of the house." I can stroll on. I thought, that's a bit strong. Got off the phone quite quickly. Didn't ring them again. But no, I got a sponsor and learned who to ring up, really. And I didn't have a phone. No one had mobiles. That was to go down the phone box, and that used to scare me. But standing in the phone box with my list of numbers, I had 23. I was in Norfolk, and I had 23 numbers. I thought, right, if they're not in, I'm going to use. And I'd start down the list with the people who sort of talk the most. They're the people I used to ring up, the people who talk the most, because I used to be frightened that I wouldn't be able to say anything. And there was people who found it quite easy, you know, good talkers, so I'd ring them up, you know what I mean, because I'm in recovery and you have to ring people up. And I got a sponsor, and it was the person who I could see was as different to me as I could possibly get. As I was still, you know, when I got clean, I had fines to pay, I had debts to pay, I had no money, I had to wear the clothes that I had in my using, except some of them obviously didn't fit me, not being 6 stone anymore, and sort of make do with that. And it was things were really, really tight, and I was still wearing my Dr. Martens that were falling apart on my feet, and I still had a skinhead, and I was still like that. And the woman I asked to sponsor me, I found this woman, and she had long hair, and she wore Laura Ashley dresses, and she wanted to be a primary school teacher. And she really believed in God, and I thought, that's my sponsor. That's, if I'm going to change, then I've got to find someone as far removed from who I think I, you know, who I am. And I did. And she had an English degree, and I wanted to go to school, you know. And she was from America. She moved to another country, which I just thought was incredibly brave. And she, you know, she was happy. She got moved to England, got married, and just started a whole new life and gone, right, I want to do this. And I just thought, God, if I could have just a gram of the courage she's got, that would do me. And so if I'm going to go through the steps, I want to do it with someone as brave as that. And my whole sort of concept of bravery had changed in recovery. It was, you know, I'd heard about the courage to change, and I always thought courage was to do with fronting things out. And not backing down to people. I didn't know it was about facing my fears and moving through them. And I followed this woman, and she took me through the steps. And everyone's experience is different. I don't think if I hadn't done a step four and got all that stuff out, I don't know if I'd still be here. I felt like I was being buried under the weight of all the things that had happened, and there were some major things I really had to get off my chest, and secrets that I'd kept for a lot of years, and I was able to do that within that relationship. And the faith issue was something that I thought probably wouldn't be available to me, because I still had a belief that I was fundamentally evil and corrupted and corrupting in some way, and that was something I still have to work on, that stuff. And but I don't think I could have survived without that. I don't think I could have muddled through really without that and still been here. And there were some suggestions I did take on when people said relationships. I heard a year, so I did that. My marriage just broke up. He wanted to use, and I didn't. It was amicable. You know, he did a very loving thing in letting me go and moved out of my way and let me get on with it. And I'm very grateful to him for that. I wanted to save him as well. And he had to make his own choices. But I'm still very grateful to him for letting me go. So staying out of relationships for a year, that was no biggie. It just sort of left who I thought was my other, you know, my whatever you want to call it, in the addiction, and that was the last thing I wanted to do, really. So after my year was up, almost to the week, I went and got in a relationship, because I thought that's what you're supposed to do. It took me 3 months to find out. I didn't really like this person very much, didn't really get on with them, you know, and got out of one. And I think what I maybe did need to know was that I shouldn't get into a relationship until I knew how to get out of one, really, you know. But I had to learn that along the way, and I was glad for all those things. I was glad that for all those things that were passed on and people just sort of looking out for me, really, because I didn't have a clue how vulnerable I was in early recovery. You know, got a few months clean, and still, as the compulsion took a while to go for me, I still thought about drugs a lot. I still felt threatened. I still thought there was inevitability about my sort of self-destruction. But so I was just glad to have people watching my back. And there was, my life changed again when I was 18 months clean, and my brother died. I was with him at the time, and my mother was stood opposite me at the other side of the bed in the intensive care unit in Bath, and we said goodbye to him, and he died. I was there, I was clean, I was standing next to him, and I was watching. There was a morphine in a drip, in loads of it, and it was a foot away from me, and I knew then, that was when I realised that there was no drug that was going to touch that pain. And that all that time I'd been using drugs, I'd been trying to kill emotional pain, and that's not what the drugs were designed for. The drugs were designed for people in like a really bad way, or who were in really bad physical pain, and all the time I'd been using them to try and get rid of this emotional pain, and the best I could hope for is that they would just put me in a sleep for a few hours, and I was going to wake up and it was still going to be there and it was going to get worse. And that was like, it was a huge turning point for me. It was also, it was my brother's life, and it, you know, when I got clean and I thought, well, if this happens and if that happens, I'll have to use, and if this happens, I'll have to use. But when it was my brother's life, there was no way that I wanted to disrespect his memory in using him as an excuse to take myself out. And also, I was going to be an only child then. How could I do that to my parents? And no, at times that's kept me clean as well. There's been, I kind of expected, I was very young at the time, but I kind of expected bad things to stop happening in my using. After that first person died when I was 18, then another one, then another one, then another one. By the end of my using, if I heard someone died, I'd say, I don't want to fucking know. I'm not going to any more funerals. I don't want to know. Just don't tell me that stuff anymore.
And I sort of got desensitised to it, really. And I thought, that was something I thought, you get clean and you try hard and you do the right thing and good things happen. Because good things did happen. They happened to me and they were happening to other people. I think what I didn't bargain for was that life still happens. And part of life is losing people. Part of life is grief. Part of life is, you know, people moving on. And sometimes things don't go how I want them to go, and sometimes I'm never going to find out why. You know, the lesson in nearly everything for me is acceptance, but sometimes I'm never going to know why. There's not going to be an answer. There's not going to be the answer. It's just the way it is. And, you know, if I could have made a list of all the worst things that could have happened, some of them have, but I did make a list of what I wanted to happen. It was recommended to me when I first got clean to go and make a list of the things I wanted to happen, and I've still got it, and it's when I very first got clean. And I can tell by my writing, because it looks like it's written by like a seven-year-old. And the first thing on it was I wanted to go to sleep. I wanted a night's sleep. I wanted a 30-day keyring. I wanted to go to school. I wanted my dogs to be happy. I wanted to have some friends. And the last one I thought, oh, I'd be really daring, really push the boat out. I want to go to another country. And those things, you know, if some of the worst things came true, then all them things came true, and they came true really quickly. And I heard you talk the other week, Simon, I heard you do a chair, and what was really nice, and what I came away with, nice warm feelings, because you said about the things that have gone right, you know, the things you had done, and I find it a lot easier to sit in meetings and tell you about all the things I've fucked up, and to tell you all the things that have gone right, and things I have done in my recovery. I did go to university, I did get a degree, I did go to another country, I worked there for a year. I had to learn a language so I could go to meetings and share. I've been bungee jumping in Amsterdam, I've been hang gliding over Rio de Janeiro, I've been swimming with sharks in Koh Phi Phi. All these mad, I didn't have the imagination to put them on my list, I wanted a night's sleep, you know what I mean? I was tired, I'd like some new boots, please. I just couldn't have dreamed it up. I've been published. I took all the most horrible things that ever happened to me, invented a fictional character, wrote them all down and sold it. That's all right, you know? And now I'm doing an MA now, and I spend my days pretty much doing what I want to do. There's very little I have to do. I've just got a new sponsor. I feel like I need some more guidance, you know. I want to go through the steps again, and I'd like to try it someone else's way. I found someone who's got something I want, and I'd like to try it their way. And so I do that. Go to meetings, but now I do things I like, and it took me years to find out what I did like. I had to try a lot of other people's clothes on until I found out what fitted, you know. I had to try a lot of other people's hobbies and a lot of other people's opinions until I found out what felt right for me. And now there's no, I can make, the freedom I've got is that I can make my decisions about what I like, and I can play whatever music I want, and I can wear whatever I want. And the people that I'm around aren't interested in what's cool. I don't have to worry about what other people think. I don't spend any time with people that make me feel uncomfortable. The only people I'm around are people that let me feel good about myself. And that's such freedom. I like going to the gym. I like going out for coffee. I like eating cake, playing PlayStation, taking my dog to dog school, which is incidentally where I learnt about boundaries. More than anything else. I like these things. I can decide for myself. When I get up in the morning, my aching legs don't kick in and drag me out. I don't sit there waiting for that clock in the corner of the screen to tell me it's time to go to the chemist. I go to sleep at night, turn everything off and go to sleep. I wake up in the morning and decide what I want to do. And that's freedom. That's beyond my wildest dreams, because my wildest dreams were really, really small when I came here. And I feel really grateful for that. And I think that's about me. I feel very heard. Thank you very much.